Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life is produced by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, a division of the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences. Visit us online at whyradioshow.org.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. On today's episode, we will be asking Cory Doctorow what it means to keep the internet free. A long time ago, in 1995, I was fortunate enough to be in Vienna, Austria, and participate in the 9th annual European Meeting of Cultural Magazines. The conference involved a small representative of art and culture publications that were trying to find their way in the new world. The newly created World Wide Web had opened to the public 2 years earlier, and as everyone knows, it shook the publishing industry. Independent niche magazines felt the seismic shift more than anyone else. Vienna is the meeting place of Eastern and Western Europe, and the conference represented that cultural divide. The participants had two fundamental differences of opinions. Folks from the West were overwhelmed by the internet's size and wondered how creativity would avoid getting lost in the vastness. People from the East were upset about the web's lack of permanence. If you could edit any web page or delete any file, how could you ensure that history could not be rewritten? All of this was in character. The former Soviet republics were still unsteadily recovering from the Union's collapse, and capitalists were taking a victory lap. The East was worried that power would win the internet, and the West feared that money would. No one was confident about what was to come. Just yesterday, I scanned my copy of the limited edition magazine we published to commemorate the event. It's in English, French, and German, and asks, "What would a computerized Europe of the new millennium look like?" There's an article about community cohesion in Albania and one about cultural journals in Romania. I wrote an article about the way the web balances individuality and community. Someone else talks about how computers made him feel old. What is overwhelming about this artifact is that the questions everyone was debating during the birth of the web are the same ones everyone is asking now. Is the internet a place of freedom and creative exploration, or is it a place where power, manipulation, and illusion win out? Is the ephemeral nature of the web its greatest asset or its worst quality? Does the fact that anyone can publish a website make cyberspace democratic and egalitarian? Or does that just create a chaotic anarchy that crushes individuals under the boots of their larger, more affluent competitors? The answer to all of these questions was the same then as it is now. Yes. Yes, the internet is free and manipulated. Yes, its changeability is a gift and a burden. Yes, it is individualistic and corporate. As I wrote in 1995, the web is the latest manifestation of the great tensions of human life. We are not consistent creatures. We are driven by a universe of forces that pull us in a myriad of ways. If the media we use to communicate are not as complex as we are, they cannot be useful. They will not last. Sophisticated tools bring with them sophisticated problems. But we are not children. We shall not go gentle into the good night. On today's episode, we're asking what it means to keep the internet free. This itself is an ambiguous question. The term free can have a lot of different meanings, like costless or fluid. It can mean welcoming, as a commune might be, or without boundaries, like meditation. Free can imply rule-breaking, as in free jazz, or revealing, like an uninhibited conversation. We're so used to freedom being a political watchword that we forget how expansive the concept really is. We tend to talk about the internet only as the literal network that connects our computers, disregarding our thoughts, feelings, and behaviors when we interact with it. But the internet can only be as free as its users. It's like when we go to a neighborhood restaurant and always order the same thing off the menu. It doesn't matter that the chef offers dozens of delectable options for our dining pleasure. For us, that restaurant has no variety. I suppose, then, that the most instructive starting point for our conversation is the magazine I scanned yesterday. Only 99 were printed, so I'm sure no more than 150 people worldwide even know it exists. But I'm going to post it on my blog and share the link. I bet it will be read by more people that first day than in the last 25 years. I'm also confident it will find its way to the original contributors, all because I happen to have a scanner on my phone and I was looking for something to talk about to start out this show. The internet is free in the same way that all human creations are. It's unpredictable, and it has a life of its own. It can't be directed, but it can be nudged. The web came with risks, but that's okay. Everything else does too. We've all become so used to our connectivity that we've forgotten the internet should be dangerous. It's supposed to be more than we can handle. At least, that's how we all felt back in 1995, and that's why we published a magazine. After all, if there wasn't so much at stake, what would we have to write about? And now our guest. Cory Doctorow is a science fiction author, activist, and journalist, and the co-editor of Boing Boing, one of the internet's biggest blogs. He's written numerous books, including Information Doesn't Want to Be Free, and most recently, Radicalized. Cory, welcome to Why.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
This episode has been pre-recorded, but if you'd like to comment, tweet us at Why Radio Show, post on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Why Radio Show, or email us at askwhy@und.edu. You can always find a complete archive at whyradioshow.org. So, Cory, you're a science fiction writer. You're co-editor of a massively influential blog. You've been doing this a long time. Is your life on the internet what you expected? Is the daily life of Cory Doctorow like something out of a science fiction novel?
Well, I think those are two very different questions. This is not the future I expected, but it is recognizably out of a certain genre of science fiction novel. I think that when we look at science fiction, we tend to mistake it as a predictive literature. But I think that at best, it's a kind of maybe like an oracle, in the sense that science fiction writers have no more insight into the future than anyone else does. But they imagine a lot of different futures. And then collectively, as a society, we elevate some of them and then downrank others based on our own aspirations and fears. And so, you know, when you look at things like the rise of cyberpunk literature just before the internet came along in the mid-80s, before lots of people found their way online. And in fact, you know, it was a part of the reason people did find their way online. One of the features of those novels is unchecked corporate power, just vast unchecked corporate power. And I think that it was a kind of collective unconscious response to the rise of Reaganism and its correlates around the world. Here in Canada, where I'm speaking to you from today, we had Mulroneyism, and in the UK they had Thatcherism, and in Germany they had Kohlism, and so on. And I think that there was this sense that the gloves were coming off for a new kind of robber baron who would be allowed to do almost anything, and who would amass so much power that the idea of a democratic law would be set aside for a kind of private law, and that we would be moving towards a statutory regime that you might call like felony contempt of business model, where we would be increasingly obliged to arrange our affairs to benefit an increasingly small cadre of elite shareholders and not to our own benefit. And I think that, you know, that science fiction novel is recognizably the internet, right? I think that we underestimated the extent to which the internet could someday become five giant websites filled with screenshots from the other four. And that diversity would be squeezed out, and that our ability to communicate would be centralized through a few gatekeepers who would be able to arbitrarily and capriciously decide what we said and what we didn't say and who we could talk to and who we couldn't.
So I often talk about the movie Logan's Run because I feel like it invented Tinder, at least. There's a whole subplot in the movie about people who put themselves on the system and appear in other people's rooms, and they have sex with the people that they find attractive just based on the way they look. And at the same time, Logan's Run is about killing people at a certain age, the lack of diversity, absolute control that allows people to play. Do you think that that tension is being played out on the internet, in the sense that if we look at enough science fiction, are we going to find everything that we see before us now, and we're just sort of cherry picking to call the predictive power accurate? Or do you think that there's something about the collective therapy that really gets it right, even if we don't necessarily know what right is going to look like in advance?
I'm going to say neither. You know, we just had the bicentennial of Frankenstein, and Frankenstein's vogue has come and gone over the years. And Frankenstein, considered as a kind of parable about fears and aspirations, it can have a lot of different valences, right? It can have a lot of different meanings. It can be about hubris. It can be about, you know, the pride of a creator. It can be about what it means to be human. It can be about technology out of control. It can be about more than one of those things. And you see the rise and fall of Frankenstein in different years based on different social conditions. And so the fact that a story resonates in 1970, whatever, when Logan's Run came out, and resonates again in 2019, doesn't necessarily mean that the same phenomenon is making it resonate. Like, at a guess, I would say that Logan's Run's initial popularity, inspiration, and resonance had more to do with the aging of the boomers, who were finding themselves at, first of all, at the tail end of the politicization of that generation, right? We're moving from the politicized to the depoliticized, and the heading towards the greedy 80s and the me generation moment. You know, Jerry Rubin is becoming a real estate broker, and instead of being an anarchist activist. Right. It's also a very hedonistic time. It's a time where the sexual revolution of the 60s becomes the sexual revolution of the 70s, which has different meanings for different groups. You know, obviously for gay people, it's the beginning of gay liberation and, you know, the year of Stonewall. But for straight people, it was the transmutation or the elevation of the elements of the sexual revolution that had always been about a kind of institutionalized misogyny. Again, with the gloves off, where you go from, the misogyny of the 50s, which is supposed to be sexless and in which women are supposed to resist men, into misogyny of the 60s, in which women are supposed to be available to men, to the misogyny of the 70s, in which women are supposed to stop caring about the political valence of being available to men and not available to men. And still, there's still this kind of entrenched sexism in that kind of hedonism. And so, you know, when you talk about Logan's Run and being a precursor to Tinder, I think it probably has more to do with that kind of dynamic than what Tinder has to do with today. Although, as I agree that Logan's Run resonates with Tinder today. When you see that scene, it feels predictive, but I think it's referring to something else, and so on and so on. You know, when you think about the collapse of, you know, the eugenic elements of Logan's Run, where they're sending people off to die when they reach a certain age. I mean, that's pretty clearly about boomer anxiety, right? About a generation whose slogan had been "Don't trust anyone over 30," all turning 30, and you know, feeling that way as they get there. Today, you know, our surplus population ideas, notwithstanding all the talk about millennials killing this or millennials killing that, our surplus population is mostly about the anxiety that we're headed towards an unnecessariate, where, you know, some combination of automation and hoarding of the benefits of automation will make most people irrelevant, regardless of their age. And we're going to, you know, that this will create some kind of like social instability. And, you know, our social betters will need to figure out some way to quietly sweep us off the map, because we'll no longer be needed, not even as a group of unemployed people whose existence terrorizes the people who are employed into accepting lower wages because they could be fired and replaced with one of us.
So let me follow it up with a question about your most recent book. So Radicalized is four novellas of stories that are very different from one another. And in the second one, you tell the story of a superhero who is watching the police to make sure that they're not overly brutal. That's a simplistic notion. But it can be about Black Lives Matter. It can be about powerlessness. But also, you spend a fair amount of time talking about the superhero's powers and what he can do and how much he can see. When you write something like that, do you have a sense of the metaphorical powers? I mean, I want to talk to you today about the internet. And so when I'm reading that story, I'm thinking about how the superhero has internet-like powers, has surveillance, has the ability to get into places he couldn't get into. But someone else may read this as a metaphor about a story about wishing there was some overarching authority to protect African Americans from police brutality. Do you, as an author, have a priority about those themes, or do you just put it out there? We'll talk about this this later, like a dandelion, as you referred about in one of your books. Do you have a sense that you have a message, or is it just you're following the thread where it goes?
I mean, it's much more the latter. I have some heuristics for plotting that are about, you know, ensuring that the stakes are going up and that there's continuing and rising dramatic tension, and that you're trying to make the protagonist the moving force in their own lives, so that they're not too passive, so that you can root for them, and so on. But the thematic elements, I mean, there's a certain extent to which they're premeditated, but they always have they always have like minor chords that kind of resonate with them that are not necessarily in the melody when you're planning it out. And certainly in that story, I think if there's an internet metaphor to be taken from that Superman story, it's that our Superman idea is that problems have individual causes and individual solutions. We've had 40 years of being told that there is no such thing as society, as Margaret Thatcher liked to say, and that all of our problems are individual, and the answer to them is individual. You know, if we have a problem with climate change, it's because of you not being diligent enough in your recycling. If you look at your carbon footprint, the most likely major contributor to your carbon footprint is however you get from work to home, and you can't personally build a subway system. You know, our solutions to climate change are all collective, and our problems with climate change are all systemic. And so superheroes are spectacularly unsuited to the 21st century and its problems. And so Superman is kind of a relic of this idea of individual agency and individual responsibility being the be-all and end-all of our system. But, you know, he always was. If you think of the history of Superman, you know, he was created by these two Jewish kids in New York, one of them from Toronto, who were watching the unfolding history of horror of Nazism across the Atlantic, and wishing for a golem, right? Wishing for a giant who was unstoppable and immortal and omniscient and who could just go and punch Nazism until Nazism stopped. And clearly that's not how we stop Nazism. I mean, if we ever did, I guess that's an open question again. But, to the extent that we stopped Nazism, we did it through what's, I think, arguably the largest collective action in the history of the human race, conscious, planned collective action in the history of the human race. So, you know, I think that where this ties into the internet is that the internet signal virtue and its great disrupting power, sometimes for ill, is its ability to allow us to coordinate our work. You know, Ronald Coase won this Nobel Prize in economics, which I should point out is not really a Nobel Prize. Economists right. created it, got someone else named Nobel to put their name on it because they were sad that no one took them seriously as a science. But Coase won the Nobel Prize in economics for a paper called The Theory of the Firm, where he asks, like, why do we have institutions, right? Like, why do we have the church and companies and the mafia and sports teams? And he concludes that they all exist to lower the cost of coordinating work. That if the two of us are trying to knit a sweater together and one of us is unraveling it just as fast as the other one is knitting it up, we're never going to get a sweater. And so we have to spend a certain amount of time coordinating our actions, planning how we're going to collaborate. And that's what firms do. They lower the cost of collaboration. And what the internet has done is it's drastically lowered the cost of collaboration. You know, if you think about something like Wikipedia or the GNU Linux operating system, these are things on the same order of complexity as, say, like a skyscraper and getting into maybe, you know, an aviation program, if not a space program. And yet we can do them with the kind of institutional overheads that we used to bring to bear on really ambitious bake sales, right? And that is a remarkable thing. And so, you know, the fact that we are living in a moment in which we still put all of our focus on individual agency and individual culpability and individual solutions at a moment in which individuals are able to collaborate in ways that beggar the imagination of any institutional theorist from any point in history, that is a chewy contradiction for us to be in the middle of.
So is the internet, in a certain sense, the victory of saved costs from efficiency? And what I have in mind by that question is all of this collaboration on the internet has to deal with trolls and has to deal with people intentionally clogging the system. Yet that has no real monetary cost. It only has psychological cost. Will it always be cheaper to deal with and I mean cheaper, not literally, but will it always be easier, better, preferable to deal with trolls than to deal with traffic jams on the way to work or large-scale infrastructure costs in a building? Because trolls don't cost money per se, that the internet's always going to be better at coordination and more efficient because you only have to deal with the psychological impact.
So I think it's definitely true that trolling is easier when you have the internet because you can collaborate your work. And, you know, that's the story of 4chan and Reddit trolls and so on. But I don't think that's the whole story. I think that to understand how trolls have come to dominate the internet, you also have to understand how the platforms have come to dominate the internet. Because trolls are the parasites on the platforms. Trolling on smaller platforms, I mean, trolling's been around for a long time. I remember there used to be a Usenet newsgroup, which was, you know, before the web, we had these message boards called newsgroups. And this Usenet newsgroup was called Alt Syntax Tactical. And they would do things, they would call them raids. And so they would go and pretend to be cat fanciers in, you know, rec pets cats. And then they would just slowly distort the conversation as it got weirder and weirder. And it would be about, you know, the sexual proclivities of their cats and so on. But this was, it was retail, right? It was small scale retail. And the disruption was minimal compared to the kind of disruption that we have now where, you know, trolling, that there's a kind of continuum that starts with trolling and goes all the way to, you know, Rohingya pogroms. And that's definitely a new phenomenon. So I think to understand why, you have to understand that there are massive diseconomies of scale, that merging a bunch of companies together, it's only profitable because it benefits financial engineers who do things like cash out through share buybacks and who can use the lobbying muscle of the new larger firms to win tax breaks and preferential treatment in law. And it's not that they make better services. I mean, the best example you have of this is Yahoo, right? Yahoo spent 20 years buying every promising internet startup and killing it by accident. And yet it took, you know, 20 years, it took decades before their share price finally reflected their like institutional toxicity, and they got broken up for parts and sold for pennies on the dollar. And in the meantime, the people who engineered those buyouts and euthanizings of those promising companies, they all cashed out and walked away. They were long gone with their money stashed offshore in a financial secrecy haven long before Yahoo ever had to take a day of reckoning. And so Facebook is kind of the poster child for this today. It's pretty obvious that letting Facebook grow by buying all of its competitors was not good policy. Like if we had evidence-based policy and you said, is it good that 15 million Americans between the ages of 13 and 34 left Facebook last year out of disgust with the management, but the only place they could find to continue to hang out was Instagram, which is owned by Facebook. It'd be pretty obvious that that's like not a good outcome and that, you know, that we should have probably blocked that merger as we would have before the days of Ronald Reagan. It would have been radioactively illegal for Facebook to grow by buying Instagram. But you know, here we are with Facebook being this one giant platform. And Facebook does two things. The first thing Facebook does is it helps locate people who have hard-to-find traits that are widely dispersed in society. So if you're an advertiser, that trait might be someone who wants to buy a refrigerator, right? And the average person buys something like, you know, 1.8 refrigerators in their life. And so that's a really hard market to target to. And Facebook will let you do things like find all the people who searched on refrigerators, all the people who recently bought a house, who live near you, who've thought about kitchen remodeling, and you can advertise refrigerators to them. Facebook also lets users find the people they went to high school with, or the people who have the same rare disease as them, or the people who have the same unorthodox political views, whether that's Occupy or carrying tiki torches through Charlottesville chanting "Jews will not replace us" while dressed as Confederate LARPers. And Facebook does this very, very well. So well that people actually mistake Facebook for having developed a mind control ray. You know, that people say, oh, well, the way that Facebook influenced the Brexit campaign or the Trump campaign or Viktor Orban or any of these other fringe phenomena that have become, you know, the dominant forces in our world is because they figured out how to use machine learning to tell you exactly the right thing to make you become a racist.
Corey, I'm sorry, I have to interrupt because we have to take a break, but I want to pull this thread when we get back because I want to talk about the tensions between your new book, Radicalized, and a previous book, Information Doesn't Want to Be Free, because the first is about the perspective of a user and the second is the perspective of the internet itself. But we will be back in a minute. You're listening to Corey Doctorow and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We'll return shortly.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. I'm talking with Corey Doctorow about what it means for the internet to be free and whether it can stay that way. In his most recent book, Radicalized, the first story tells the story of a woman who you meet her in an apartment. You don't know anything about her. And she's trying to toast bread. And she can't toast bread because the toaster only uses proprietary bread. And the company has gone bankrupt. And so it's a useless piece of equipment. This is like in the first paragraph. So I'm not giving anything away. And the story follows the experience of someone and people who are faced with this notion of having no control over their appliances. In an earlier book, Corey, called Information Doesn't Want to Be Free, Corey explains the inner workings of the internet largely by talking about two very basic things, copyright law or how copyrights work, and the fact that files are actually copied in multiple places. Now, that doesn't sound particularly interesting, but it's a wonderful book. It's easy to understand. It's entertaining and it's incredibly informative. And the way that I understand the two books is, as I said before the break, Radicalized tells the story from the perspective of the user, and Information Doesn't Want to Be Free tells the tells from the perspective of the people who control the internet and the internet itself. So, Corey, I want to ask you, when we were last talking before the break, you were talking about Facebook in a way that I've never heard anyone talk about Facebook before. You were talking about Facebook from the perspective of the people who designed Facebook to do particular tasks that are largely about making money, but that solve very particular problems. Does the internet make more sense? Is there an overarching order to the internet once you take it from that perspective?
So I think that to understand how we got this internet, five giant websites filled with screenshots from the other four, you have to understand that tech and the dismantling of antitrust grew up together. And so a lot of what we think of as phenomena of the internet are really phenomena of monopoly. You know, there's a kind of technological exceptionalism that says that the reason we have one search engine and it spies on you, and the reason that the largest phone company won't let you decide which software you run on your phone, and the reason that the only way to talk to your friends is to be spied on and locked into a walled garden, is because of like these nebulously defined ideas like network effects or first mover advantage. And the thing is that the monopolies that we see in tech are not unique to tech. 30 years ago, there were 20 wrestling leagues. Now there's one wrestling league. It's worth $3.5 billion. Its owner treats every wrestler in the league as a contractor and doesn't let them get medical insurance through it. And they're dropping dead like crazy.
I did not know that.
Yeah. And we also have, you know, three giant car companies and five giant banks and four giant record labels and five giant publishers, which will soon be four. And we had five giant movie studios, and now it's four because Disney and Fox just merged. And none of that stuff is explained by first mover advantage and network effects and all this other, you know, foo-for-ah. And when I hear people who are advocates for this like radical theory of capitalism that Reagan brought in talk about why it's not dismantling monopoly protections that gave us monopolies, it always reminds me of lifelong smokers explaining why their lung cancer wasn't caused by their cigarettes.
Right.
You know, it's this kind of exceptionalism that says the thing that I enjoyed and that I was like, that everyone told me I was wrong about is clearly not why I'm in trouble. I'm in trouble because of, you know, some other force, right? Some nebulously defined force. And so we can talk about the internet's unique characteristics, and it has some, right? It's the internet is universal in a way that very few technologies we've had before is. And when I say it's universal, I mean that the computers that sit at the edges of the internet can run any program that we can express in symbolic logic. This is a huge shift from the computers before, you know, the modern computing, when, like, if you wanted to tabulate the census, you would build an electromechanical computer and it could do one kind of computation. Now we just have a computer and we load different software on it. And this sounds trivial, but it's seismic because it means that every device we have is just becoming a computer in a fancy case. As you mentioned in Unauthorized Bread, toasters become computers in fancy cases. And that may sound fanciful, but today, you know, a voting machine is a computer you put a democracy inside of, and right. A pacemaker is a computer you put inside of your body, and a 747 is a flying computer in a fancy aluminum case, right? And a 737 is a fancy, badly designed computer in a fancy aluminum case. And so that universality of the endpoints is then complemented by the universality of the network, where prior to internet networking protocols, we built a different network for every purpose, right? You had a phone network for voice, and you had a cable network for television, and you had specialized data networks for different data applications. You physically would string new wires around. And now we have one wire, and it's heterogeneous. So parts of it are wire, and parts of it are fiber, and parts of it are satellite. And it carries every kind of information that we can express as digital data. And so voice and video and so on have just become applications for this one network. So those are unique, right? Those are things that have never been on the face of the earth before. But there are other ways in which the internet is absolutely ordinary, right? The internet is captured by the same forces that have captured all of our other institutions. So the denialism that makes our bad internet policy so easy, where we insist that things that are obviously wrong will be fine in the end, that's the same denialism that makes us, you know, burn coal, right? It's just that the preferences and parochial goals of a small number of rich people get to dominate our policy outcomes, even and especially when they fly in the face of our best evidence. And so in that sense, the internet's totally ordinary.
Is I'm not sure how to ask this question. Is everything ordinary? And what I mean by that is, are we just manifesting human problems, human tendencies, human desires through whatever tool we use, and we just have developed better, more efficient, more fanciful tools? Or is the medium the message in that classic sense, in that how we are going to use something and how we're going to care about something is going to be different based on the kind of tool that we're using?
So again, I'm going to say neither. I think that
you figured out the secret to talking to me.
right. Yeah. Human beings are mixed bags, right? We clearly, there's nobility and venality in all of us. And the forces that bring the good or the bad to the surface, they're determined by a lot of other things in the world, right? So one of the things we know is that if you tell people that the world is a game of musical chairs, while we might have had abundance before, those days are behind us and things will get more and more scarce. And if you haven't figured out how to fill up your 401k by the time you hit a certain age, then it's not just that you're going to be eating dog food. You might become dog food. That people become graspier and meaner and less generous. Whereas if you tell people that we have a shared destiny, and if you show them that their generosity is reciprocated, then they become more generous, right? And so, the conditions for our world are determined by like the incentives that we set up in our society. And I think that, in the case of whether everything is normal and whether we're just living through human nature being expressed, I don't think that's true. And I think that you can see that it's not true if you look at the way we behave depending on how our wealth is distributed, right? After the two world wars, America and the world were more equal than at any time, I think, at least since manumission, right? Because most of the American national wealth had been represented in enslaved bodies, the manumission meant that most of the wealth was wiped off the books at the stroke of a pen, and America became one of the most equal nations in the world. And it also became a nation in which suddenly a lot of policy reflected evidence, right? Maybe we were wrong about what the best thing to do was, but we weren't wrong because someone had suborned the process. We were wrong because the process was not sophisticated enough to get at the truth. But, we followed the truth as best as we could understand it using the most objective methods we had. The same is true after the two wars, right? After the two wars, there had been so much capital destruction that America was super, super equal, as was the rest of the world. The French call those next 30 years les 30 glorieuses, right? The 30 glorious years. And around the world, you have unparalleled prosperity and pluralism and mobility and people who had been historically viewed through a kind of crypto eugenics as being poor because they were lesser and lesser because they were poor, suddenly ascending through the ranks and showing themselves to have meaningful things to contribute to all of our collective well-being. And the thing that happens after 30 years is that the share of wealth controlled by the top decile has accumulated into a small enough number of hands and has become significant enough in terms of the overall wealth all over the world that rich people start to be able to make their preferences into law again, as they had been able to do for 500 years before that in Europe and for, 70 years before that in America, as the wealth concentration reemerged after manumission. And we lost our ability to make good policy. And so in that sense, the internet is just like everything else, but not because it's human nature, but because when you live in an aristocracy, it is rotten, right? Aristocrats are a form of rot because their individual fanciful notions, their prejudices, their biases, and their parochial priorities to feather their own nests trump all evidence-based policy. So, we have bad policy about the internet, but there was just a hearing in West Virginia over whether or not the state levels of allowable chemical effluent in drinking water should be lowered below the national levels. And Dow Chemical is the largest employer in the chemical industry in West Virginia. The chemical industry is the largest industry in West Virginia. And their lobbyists submitted comments that said, well, of course, West Virginians can tolerate higher levels of toxic waste in their water because they have a higher BMI than the average American. And those national levels were set based on the BMI of the average American. And since West Virginians are so much fatter, the poison will be more diluted in their tissues. And besides that, they just don't drink as much water as other Americans. That is the kind of answer that you put into a regulatory proceeding when you have run out of any kind of sense that you care what people think of you, when you know that your parochial priorities will become law, provided that you can fill in even the most meaningless, ridiculous justification for making them law.
It sounds like everything you said applies to the question of net neutrality. And net neutrality, mm-hmm. in my oversimplified articulation, is that regardless of the players, regardless of how much money they spend, regardless of preferences, the rule of net neutrality has to be everyone's data has to be treated the same at the same speed. But there are people, corporations in particular, that don't want that. So the question I think I'm trying to get at is, given the fact that your articulation was about money, power, and class, is there any way to talk about net neutrality that isn't ultimately just a question about people on the top that are just trying to take more and make more.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think net neutrality is one of those issues where it's only complicated because if you laid it out simply, it would be obvious what the right answer is, right? It's complicated for the same reason there are a ton of lines on the craps table, because it makes it impossible to calculate the odds, right? And if you just said, this is craps, it is a 75% expectation game. That means every dollar that you put in, you get 75 cents back and you will lose 25 cents. Craps would be a lot simpler. You wouldn't even need a bunch of lines, right? You could just have like a four-sided dice. And if it came up a one, you lost your money. And the other times you got your money back. And you would have exactly the same expectation, right? So the way to understand net neutrality, you know, there are all these arguments that complexify it. You know, people say, well, when you go to Google, Google gets to decide what goes on the front page. How come when you get your internet, the internet service provider doesn't get to decide which search engine you use? Isn't that just the same thing? And the right answer there is that if you live in a city with a regulated taxi industry, and I know that's increasingly an anachronism, and when you call a cab and you say, please take me to Macy's, and they say, I'm sorry, Macy's has not paid for premium carriage. We are going to take you to, you can go straight away to Sears, again, an anachronism, or we can circle the block for 10 minutes and then I'll take you to Macy's. The fact that Macy's store designers get to decide what's right next to you when you walk through the door doesn't change the fact that the taxi driver has no business deciding which destination you want to go to, right? Markets are supposed to be mechanisms for revealing consumer preferences. That's the whole idea of markets. That's why we like markets instead of planned economies. We say you can never know all the preferences that consumers have. The only way to know them is to see how much they're willing to pay and where they want to go and what they want to buy. Well, there's no more clearly articulated consumer preference than the link you clicked. What did you want to see? The thing that you clicked the link for. What didn't you want to see? The thing that maximizes shareholder benefit. That's, you know, it's an inarguable proposition. And the idea that we have ISPs who, after all, only exist because they get giant public subsidies, because, you know, if you're Verizon and you're going to operate in New York and you don't have a public subsidy, then you have to go around the city and pay people to dig up their basements and their streets, and you have to pay what could be trillions of dollars to dig up the whole city to wire it with your, you know, going Galt Ayn Rand pure market network, and you will never recoup. Because they are creatures of public regulation, and because they take giant amounts of public subsidy in the form of these rights of way, they should have an obligation to deliver the things that we click on, not the things they wish we'd clicked on. And it's just that simple. And the fact that we're having this argument in America is hilarious, not least because 87% of Americans both know what network neutrality is and want it. And so we don't even have a split over whether or not network neutrality is the right or the wrong policy. You know, we talk a lot about America as though it were polarized, and we say, well, there's people who want universal health care and people who don't, and people want net neutrality and people who don't. The reality is that most of those policies enjoy clear bipartisan majorities, and America is polarized not between the left and the right, but between a tiny elite of nest featherers in Washington, D.C., and the entire rest of the country.
All right, so I want to take a step back, because the conversation has been complex in a certain sense and fast in a certain sense, and that in other ways it's following a very, very clear path. And so I want to orient our listeners for a second. I started the conversation by wanting to talk about technology and actually talking about science fiction. And Corey's response was, you can't talk about any of that stuff unless you talk about the economic context and unless you talk about the political context. And in fact, all explanations that you're going to ask for, whether technological or literary, are still bound by these larger questions. They're not human nature questions. They're circumstance questions. They're economic questions. They're political questions. So I want to ask what's going to seem like a far afield question to follow up on this, but in part because it's a question I wanted to ask a long time ago, but I think that it leads to more of this, which is the question that I thought I was going to end up starting the conversation with was as follows. How is a blog different than a magazine? And what I wanted to sort of juxtapose in the conversation was I wanted to ask first, you commented in something you wrote that you post about 10 posts a day on Boing Boing. And those posts are usually discrete. They don't necessarily have anything to do with each other. There's not necessarily a coherent narrative. They're responses to things you find, pictures of the other websites, but also tech stuff and science fiction stuff and your opinions and things like that. When you look at a blog like Boing Boing, is it just a stream of consciousness experience of what happens to go in front of the poster when the poster decides to put something online? Or is there an overarching logic that then we can analyze by all of these other things? Is a blog just a piecemeal experience based on the vicissitudes of life, what happens to go in front of someone's face? Or is a blog much more coherent in a way that appears invisible to a lot of the readers?
Mm-hmm. So I think that to answer with an answer that might start a little far afield and come in, I think the internet exposes that a lot of things that we think of as being clearly defined categories are actually much broader than we assumed. You know, book being a good example. Right. I mean, we used to have, you know, maybe you would have the philosophical conundrum, like, is the IKEA catalog a book? And if so, how is it a book, like the Bible is a book, or like, Mein Kampf is a book? And are they books like the phone book is a book? But now we have things like, is Wikipedia a book, you know,
right.
And is a Kindle book that's in the Kindle Unlimited program that was put together by a grifter hoping to goose their stats to get more money from Amazon by doing keyword stuffing that's only 100 words long. Is that a book? Right? Like, so now we have this much, you know, the thing that we thought of as a unitary category becomes much larger. You see it happening in lots of different areas, right? Like when Google had a policy that said everyone had to use their real name on Google+, it sparked, you know, a lot of anger about what a real name was. And there's a great article called Things Programmers Believe About Names That Are Wrong. And it includes things like everyone has a name, everyone has one name, everyone's name can be written, everyone's name is written left to right, everyone's name is read top to bottom, and so on. And, you know, there are examples of people who don't fit into any of those categories. And you know, eventually the exceptions start to swallow the rule. And so blog is one of these things where it seems unitary, but the closer you look at it, the more diffuse and harder it is to find the border where something stops being a blog and starts being something else is. But the one characteristic I think you could say that at least blogs shared in their early years is that they were not capital intensive, and so they were experimental, right? After Blogger came along, which eventually became part of Google, you could create a blog in a few seconds for free. And that meant that there were lots of different things that became blogs that were created for different reasons by different people. And the category very quickly became as varied as the category of book. So there are blogs that are as different from each other as the IKEA catalog, Mein Kampf, the phone book, and my most recent novel are, even though they're all recognizably blogs because they have the same content management system and they're in reverse chronological order and they have permanent links on every post and all those things that were like formal characteristics of blogs when they started. So for me, my contributions to Boing Boing, which are different from everyone else's contributions to Boing Boing because it's a collective effort and there's half a dozen of us. And one of the things that you see blogs doing is lowering coordination costs so we can have half a dozen of us who are all working on the blog for different reasons to post different things that have different priorities, and yet it's still recognizably one blog. For me, the blog is my commonplace book, and writers have always kept these, right? They make notes in a book or in a notebook about the things that cross their transom, that seem like they're relevant, that seem like they might be synthesized later into something longer and more complex. But the problem with making notes for yourself is that you cheat. Right. When you don't have to explain what you mean to a notional third party and just explain what you mean to yourself, you are powerfully tempted to say, oh, I'm sure I'll know what I mean later. I can just jot down a few words. And I don't know about you, but I usually am wrong about how much detail I'm going to need
right.
to recall what I meant later. And I have notebooks full of cryptic notes that I have no idea what they mean. But when you write for an audience, you have to apply rigor. And so that's why these posts stand alone, is because they try to tell the who, what, where, when, why, how story of the fragment. And that itself becomes powerfully mnemonic. It helps you remember it. It turns your subconscious into a kind of super saturated solution of fragmentary ideas that can glom together and nucleate and crystallize into bigger, more synthetic pieces. But it also creates not just the ability to bring it to mind more easily in your memory, but it creates a database that's searchable and that self-annotates, because readers who share your interest come along and tell you how you're wrong and tell you how you're right and tell you what you missed. And so this is like a magical commonplace book for me, and it's become so integral to everything else I do that it is extremely idiosyncratic and specific. But I would hazard a guess that the majority of people who identify as bloggers, which is obviously a very small number of people today relative to its heyday a few years ago, a decade ago, that very few of them share that my view of what a blog is good for.
You've touched upon a problem that I was thinking about when you were talking about the philosophical conundrum of what a book is, because a book means one thing, but the major difference between the book that we hold in our hand and the Kindle is that the book that we hold in our hand is a codex, right? It's mm-hmm. it's this book structure with papers and a binding. And what people don't realize about the Kindle is that ultimately it's a scroll, and that it goes back to the older style of writing. Mm-hmm. And one of the advantages of a codex is it's easy to search. It's easy to find things. And one of the disadvantages of a scroll is it's incredibly difficult to search and incredibly difficult to find things. So Kindle has a search function that is supposed to make it seem easier to find things, but it's actually fairly difficult. You have to type things in. You have to get the word right, right? With a codex, you can sort of flip through pages and find your notes. Mm. I think a blog suffers from a potentially similar problem, which is when you have all of these posts, it's incredibly hard to find things, but you then have tags and you have keywords and you have people's comments. So this isn't really what I intended to ask when I started the question, but is a blog more like a codex in the sense that because it's a commonplace book, because you're trying to remember things, it's actually easy to scroll through things and find? Or is the fundamental retrieval problem of a blog the same, which is that it deposits information, but it's incredibly hard to recall information?
I want to beg to differ about whether Kindles are better or worse at searching and finding. And that, I think, is also the answer to your blog question, which is that Kindles are worse at searching in the way that we search books, and better at searching in the way that we search data. And mm-hmm. books are better at searching in the way we search books, and worse at searching in the way that we search data. So Kindles for me, you know, I don't own a Kindle because of the digital rights management stuff, but electronic books, I will often read a book as a book. And then when I want to review it, I will download the book and search it to find the quotes that I want to reference in my review. And that for me, that synthesis, you know, that benefit of having both, right? The best of both worlds, that for me is what I'm after. And I think blogs are really good at being searched like blogs and really bad at being searched like commonplace books. But, you know, I'm 3,000 miles from home right now. My commonplace books, which had been in a storage locker in Wales for 5 years until 2 weeks ago, are on a bookshelf in my garage in Burbank, California, and I'm in Toronto. So those commonplace books are not available to me, whereas my blog is available to me anywhere I am where there's data. And, you know, by the same token, it's true that if there was network censorship or if there was something catastrophic in terms of our ability to continue to use technology, that I might lose access to that blog data. But it's also true that that blog data has been backed up by the Internet Archive, and that I can make a backup of it and store it on-site or off-site in the cloud or on an encrypted hard drive, which would allow me to not only have a copy of it that I could access from anywhere in the world, but also access and be sure that no one else could access it, because if you use encryption well, it is extremely robust and reliable. And so it's you know, it, technology giveth and technology taketh away here. There isn't a better or a worse. There's a better or worse based on the application, right? Better for some things, worse for others. And, you know, if my garage burns down, I lose those commonplace books. But, you know, we would need to have a global catastrophic event, like a cataclysm, for me to lose my blog data.
Right. So let's talk about the stuff that you said in passing, the DRM, the digital rights management, and let's talk about trying to control the information. So one of the things that happens with your blog, and of course your activism in fighting copyrights and censor walls and things like that, is all the stuff that you have is out there. Right. And anyone can use it the way they see fit. And anyone can make a certain amount of money off of it in a certain way. There are people who respond by saying, this is exactly why you need DRM, why you need digital rights management, because this is our intellectual property and we need to make money off of it. And we don't want unauthorized people to earn a living off of our hard work. We're entitled to it. You're not. You argue, A, that it's probably immoral, but B, it's completely ineffective. So what's wrong with digital rights management, and how does that show that our sense of both of copyright and its relationship to intellectual property is just completely outdated?
I was with you right until you said completely outdated, because I actually don't think that the problem with copyright is that it's outdated. I think that it's that we've evolved a new theory of copyright that's terrible.
Okay, fair enough. I'm willing to accept that.
It's a modern and radical interpretation. So copyright historically was just the regulation framework for the entertainment industry. And, right. You know, I'm a participant in that industry, but most people aren't. And you couldn't violate copyright no matter how hard you tried for most of human history, right? Unless you had a printing press or a film lab. And so the rules, you know, they're crafted around the priorities and needs of the entertainment industry. And the way that we tested to see whether you were in the entertainment industry is whether you were making and handling copies. And since that's the way the internet works, for some reason we decided, well, we're going to regulate the internet, which is the single wire that we use to do free speech and a free press and freedom of assembly and access to civic and political engagement and romance and family life and employment and education. We're going to treat that as though the best regulatory framework for it is the one that we use to make sure that Walt Disney is made whole on Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. And, you know, it's just, it's incoherent, it's bonkers, and it fails very, very badly. The thing about digital rights management, as you say, is that not only does it work badly, but it also fails badly as well. So it works badly in the sense that the laws that we have that back digital rights management in the U.S., that's Section 12.1 of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act of 1998. Here in Canada, it's Bill C-31 of 2011. In Europe, it's Article 6 of the 2001 Copyright Directive and so on. That these laws make it a crime to remove digital rights management or tamper with it, even if you're not violating copyright. And so these are not laws that protect copyright. These are laws that protect the commercial desires of copyright proprietors. So copyright proprietors have always had limits on what they could do. You know, you may have seen paperbacks that say, you know, this book must not be sold or lent. But that's right. Like, that's a preference. That's not right. A law. You can obviously sell and lend your books, right? I used to work in a used bookstore. We bought books that said that on the frontispiece all the time. Didn't matter. You know, the commercial preferences of the publisher have no bearing on what the law says. They don't get to write the law. If they want a law that says you can't buy or sell or lend books, they got to get Parliament or Congress to make that law. They don't get to just write it and make it the law. And what DRM does is it says that things that are legal, things that no Parliament has ever banned, can be made illegal through the addition of digital rights management. And this has been true since the first application for digital rights management, which was to prevent people from importing DVDs from territories where they cost less. So region coding with DVDs. Now, obviously, walking into a store in Mexico or India or China and buying a licensed DVD, that's to say not a pirate one, from a storekeeper at the price set by the creator of that movie, and then watching it on your television, that's the literal opposite of piracy, right? That's obeying copyright law. But because DVD players were designed to reject DVDs that hadn't been sold in the same country as the DVD player, to use these region codes, they could take this commercial preference that people would pay the local price for the DVD and not buy DVDs from abroad, and they could turn it into law. And that is now expanded into things like Johnson & Johnson using digital rights management in their artificial pancreas to make sure that you only use the insulin that they have made available for that pancreas and not a third-party cheaper insulin. And insulin prices are up 1,000% over the last 10 years, and Johnson & Johnson's insulin costs more than that. And so this is a way to bootstrap copyright law into forcing you to arrange your affairs to benefit a manufacturer's shareholders, even when it comes to your internal organs. And so that, on the one hand, is a matter of simple justice and economics, completely terrible. And I will put the moral case for people being allowed to use their property in lawful ways that benefit them, even if it harms the manufacturer of the product, even if it's dispreferred by the manufacturer, I will put that as being the more moral of making sure that manufacturers always make as much money as possible, even when the manufacturer or the commercial operator is an artist whose work I care about. I think that your right to earn money off of your work stops when you sell it to me, provided I don't break the law, that your preferences have no bearing on what my behavior should be. And if you don't like it, you need to go to Congress. And, you know, it's not like artists haven't tried. John Philip Sousa went to Congress in 1908 and tried to get the record player banned. He said, if these infernal talking machines are allowed to continue, we will lose our voice boxes as we lost our tails when we came down out of the trees. Many points for being an early advocate of the still controversial theory of evolution through natural selection. But he totally, you know, was wrong. Right. And I'm glad John Philip Sousa's ambitions were frustrated and that we still got records and we got sound recordings, which he was foursquare against. And so I think that the moral case is easy, but the technical case is even easier because, as I said before, we're living in an age of universal computers, computers that can run every program that anyone can express symbolically. And that means that we don't have a computer that can run all the programs except for the ones that the artist would prefer you not run, the one that makes an illicit copy or that allows you to watch an out-of-region DVD. What we have are computers that can run every program, including those dispreferred programs, but which are designed to disobey their owners, to hide how they operate from their owners, and to, when their owners ask them to do something the manufacturer would prefer they not do, to refuse to do it. And in order to accomplish this as a technical matter, you have to make the machine obscure to the user. The user can't know how it works, or they would reconfigure it to work for them. And you have to have programs that run on the computer that the user can't know about and can't stop. And what we see over and over again is that designing computers that run programs that their users don't want and that hide from their users is an invitation to all kinds of mischief. It invites manufacturers to do wicked things to users, right? To stop them from doing legitimate things, but it invites criminals and spies to figure out how to hijack that facility, to run programs that by design in the system, the user can neither know about nor prevent. And that, in a world that is made of computers, where your organs and your car and your skyscraper are all just computers in fancy cases, that is a piece of technological policy that is, in my professional opinion as a dystopian science fiction writer, a dystopian idea.
So I want to get to the meat of the matter here, both because the title of this episode is What Does It Mean to Keep the Internet Free, but also because of your work with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. One of the arguments is going to be that, at least in terms of health and the medical care, that people have a right to live, a right to medicine, a right to health care, although that, of course, is controversial in a way that it shouldn't be in any stretch of the world.
And is part of the book, too, part of Radical
and is
Lies.
Part of, right, and is part
a
of the book.
About this, yeah.
We don't have a human right to the internet. We don't have a human right to access computers. How do you respond to that, and what does it mean to have free access to these things?
Well, you know, so Stuart Brand, he coined this term, information wants to be free. It was at the first Hackers Conference, and he was on stage with Steve Wozniak, who created the first Apple computers. And he Brand is a very smart fellow, a really interesting character. And he said, you know, information has this contradictory dual nature, because on the one hand, information wants to be free, and on the other hand, information wants to be expensive. And as interesting and chewy as that is, as a kind of Zen koan about the nature of information, I think that it over the years has ended up creating more, obscuring more than it illuminated, because it shifted our focus from humans to information. And we live in an information society, which is to say that every device that we have is fundamentally a computer in a fancy case. And when I say that, I mean, like, if you take the computer out of a car, the car stops working, right? If you take the computer out of a building, right, remove the computerized HVAC, you know, if you're, for example, in the prairies, you freeze to death, right? And then after one summer, your house fills with black mold and has to be scraped down to the foundation slab. So that the most
you really do know what you're talking about.
I grew up in the Northeast. I know exactly what I'm talking about. Yeah. You know, that in that world, like, the most salient fact about these things is their information processing capacity. And that only becomes more true as years go by and will only be true for the foreseeable future. And so in an information society, people want to be free, just as they wanted to be free all along. And the way you make them free is with free, fair, and open information infrastructure. And you had a great kind of riff on all the different meanings of freedom. And I think that we could spend a whole program on each of them. But I think that there's like a dimension of freedom that we can talk about in pretty short order that is in fact not particularly novel. It's ancient. And that applies to information and information processing, that should be considered the kind of minimum viable freedom for an information society in which people are free. And it's the freedom to study, understand, modify, and discuss technology. And that freedom, it goes by another name, and that name is the scientific method. And the scientific method is approximately synonymous with progress. Right, we had 500 years of stagnation in what we now call science, and which we then called natural philosophy. And it wasn't because the people who were investigating scientific questions, the causal relationships in the universe, were stupider than they are today. It was because they lacked a rigorous method, because they were alchemists, and alchemists never told anyone what they thought they'd learned unless it was someone they trusted to keep it a secret and not discuss it with other people, which meant that their findings were only ever criticized by people who were friendly to them. And those people tend to go easy on us. And so between you and your friends, you were unlikely to discover the dumb mistakes you'd made. And this is why alchemists for 500 years discovered for themselves in the hardest way possible that you really shouldn't drink mercury, right? We call that 500-year period the Dark Ages, and we call the moment at which they began to subject their findings to scrutiny and critique by all comers everywhere in the world, including people who didn't like them and wished them harm, we call that moment the Enlightenment. And the most radical thing about the moment we're living in now is we are surrounded by systems whose inner workings we're not allowed to know, nor investigate, nor discuss. And that freedom, there are plenty of things that we can do wrong with those freedoms, but there's very little we can do right without them. You know, as Joe Lewis said when they asked him, why are you going to Europe to fight for Uncle Sam when you've been fighting Uncle Sam at home in the civil rights fight? He said, well, there's plenty wrong with the world, but Hitler's not helping, right? We can get lots of things wrong with free, fair, and open computing infrastructure, but we can't start getting them right until we have that.
You know, your comments echo actually our last episode, which was called How Does Misinformation Spread? And it was about the social networks of knowledge. And when you open up the social networks to different ideas, and I don't mean computer social networks, the social epistemology, when you open that up, you become more aware of error in a variety of ways. You also use the word technology, and that's a word that people often don't think enough about, because when we talk about technology, we think about cars and electronics. But of course, the pencil is technology. Putting two language. Rocks together is technology. Language is technology. In the midst of your discussion about free information in the book, Information Doesn't Want to Be Free, my favorite part, and I think the most moving part and the most persuasive part, talks about this in a very, very different way. I'm actually – I don't do this very often, but I'm going to read something from the book. It's on page 107. You're talking about people being spread out around the world. And you say, but today's diaspora remains tightly bound together, able to route around high long-distance tariffs with voice-over IP calling, and they enjoy services that could exist only with the internet, including video calling and video and photo sharing. And then you talk about the fact that the studies show that that the more connected people are, the healthier and happier they are in their whole lives. We are in a world where people are mobile and where people are far away from their families. And this technology coheres the family unit and often cultural and ethnic units as well and friends in a way that was never before possible. And it seems to me that while I don't know that you intended it at this point, that's also an argument for the right to the human right to the internet, because we do have a human right to family and to friends and to community. And if this helps that, then how can we ever morally justify stopping access to it? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I'm inclined to agree with you, which is unsurprising right. given that you quoted me at length. I'm pleased to find that I didn't remember that passage offhand, although when you read it, it came to mind. But yeah, my father was a displaced person, as were his parents. So his parents were Red Army deserters who came to Canada, and my grandmother lost track of her mother for 15 years after they came to Canada. She had been a child soldier in the Siege of Leningrad, who was evacuated in the third year and then inducted into the Red Army. And my dad tells this story that, you know, makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up, about being in Toronto 15 years later and the phone ringing and my grandmother answering it and saying, "Mama, Mama." And, you know, hearing her – sorry, I just choked up. It's crazy.
Yeah, I did,
and hearing
I did too.
Her mother's voice for the first time in 15 years, not having known if she was dead or alive. We are living in a moment of enormous displacement. But that story of just losing your people, that's not the story that we have anymore, right? Like, people don't live that anymore. They live smaller, shorter versions of it. But, you know, today we have different problems, you know, and the internet gives us different problems. But we don't have that problem. And that is a great ill that has been in many ways cured. Now, the other problems are equally bizarre and terrible. I have a friend who told me about going to see Doug Copeland speak after the Columbine shooting. Mm. And he got everyone in the audience to make their phone ring at the same moment. And he said, that's what it sounded like in the gym during Columbine, because all of the parents who knew that their kids were being shot at in the school called their kids. That's a completely different problem that information gives us, but and we'll have to reckon with it. But it's interesting to pose it against silence, and not just a little silence, but decades of silence about the people you love after they've been in peril.
Douglas Copeland is one of the most influential writers in my life, and it never occurred to me to try to get him on the show, but I think I'm going to do that. And what strikes me about this last turn of conversation is that it helps reveal a nuance about the earlier parts of conversation that I didn't really detect, which is by making the debate about technology and by making the debate about the sort of obscure copyright laws and the nature of the computers and things like that, we take it away from the human realm. And by taking it away from the human realm, echoing something you said earlier, obvious conclusions, especially obvious moral and policy conclusions, suddenly seem more complicated and less obvious. And I think that if you tell the stories, the two stories that you just told, all of a sudden the technological problems are tertiary because it's always going to be the human problems that take precedent for us, certainly for moral philosophers, and policy is supposed to be a branch of moral philosophy in that sense. Mm-hmm. All of this was designed to obscure the humanness of it. And I think part of what you were trying to do when you were talking about the economics and the politics was to remind us that while it takes a little while to walk down that path, ultimately these are human issues and we have to deal with them from the human side in order to understand how we have to deal with them on the technological side.
So I think that's true. But I think that there are elements in which the specifics of the technology really matter in making policy. So a good example would be working cryptography. So I mentioned before that if you use cryptography well, that it will give you secrets that you can keep in a very robust way. And when I say that, I mean like if you take a picture with your phone and your phone has disk encryption turned on, which most of them do now by default, if you bought a phone recently, it does, then that data is encrypted so thoroughly, just automatically, in the background, in the blink of an eye, that if every hydrogen atom in the universe were turned into a computer and they did nothing until the end of the universe but try and guess what key was necessary to descramble that photo, you run out of universe before you run out of keys, right? So we have working crypto, and it's pretty amazing. And it's what allows us to do things like validate the software update for your pacemaker, or your car, or your HVAC system, or your banking software, or the software that controls the fighter jet flying over you, right? And it's what stops criminals from being able to read your email or break into your systems. And so it's really, really important. It also means that if criminals use it well, that the police can't spy on them. And not just a little, but a lot, right? That if you recover a criminal's phone and you can't somehow compel the criminal to give you the keys necessary to unlock the phone, and perhaps they're dead, then you may never be able to get at that data. And since the Clinton years, cops and authoritarians and governments and spies have been agitating to ban working cryptography because they said that it is more important to make sure that we can always fight criminals than that criminals are hamstrung in their ability to attack us. And in fact, they've insisted all along, including Rosenstein, who just resigned, had insisted all along that somewhere out there was a kind of cryptography that worked perfectly when it was protecting good guys from bad guys, but failed catastrophically the instant it was protecting bad guys from good guys. And, you know, a year and a half ago, Malcolm Turnbull, who was then Prime Minister of Australia, gave a speech about this, where he said, the mathematicians tell me that the laws of mathematics say that we can't design a system that protects good guys but doesn't protect bad guys. And I say to them that the laws of mathematics are all very well and good, but I assure you that in Australia, the laws of Australia are the laws of Australia. And, you know, the championship for the stupidest thing anyone's ever said about technology, it's a highly contested cup, but he won. And now Australia has banned working cryptography. And so the human costs of banning working cryptography are really substantial. I mean, really, really substantial, right? It puts us all at risk in ways that beggar the imagination. But it does so because of a nuanced technical point. And understanding that nuanced technical point is hard. But unless we combine our moral sentiments with an understanding of the world as it is and as it may be, right? What is in the realm of what we think of as possible based on all the things we know and what we think of as impossible based on all the things we know, then we just build castles in the sky. We talk about what we would do if we could make a cryptography that worked except when we needed it to fail, not what we should do because that cryptography will never exist.
Is a free internet radically different than a free world? And what I mean by that is what a universal right is, what a human right is, applies to the bad guys as well as the good guys. And even if that division itself may be problematic. Is a free internet just free for everybody, and we're going to have to find different solutions to the problem of child porn, different solutions to the problem of revenge porn, of trolling, of compromised credit cards, that it's not an infrastructural solution. It has to be good old-fashioned police work, for lack of a better term. Is that just what a free internet looks like because free is free for everybody?
So I think you're asking more than one question there.
I always usually am.
Yeah. So to start with, a free internet is not the same as a free world, but it's the necessary but insufficient precondition for a free world.
Okay. Right?
In the same way that like a transparent democracy is not necessarily a well-governed one, but it is the precondition for good governance. Right? You have to know what people are doing and be able to criticize it and check them when they're lying and so on. Otherwise, things will always go awry. Not even because people are bad, but because they're fallible. And if no one is, if you're just living in your own little bubble and no one gets to criticize you, then you will make dumb mistakes. You'll drink mercury. So that's the first part. The second part is a free internet, one in which we can't address things like revenge porn, which is not a term I like very much. They're non-consensual nudity, images of the sexual abuse of children, where they have to be fought with police work. I mean, I think those are two very different questions, because the nude image of a consenting adult that is then shared without their consent does not have an underlying crime, right? In other words, taking a picture of yourself naked and sharing it with someone you love is not a crime. The thing that's the crime is that person or a third party getting hold of it and sharing it without your consent. Whereas images of the sexual abuse of children start with a crime, right? They start with an illegal act. And I would argue that if all we manage is to snuff out the sharing of the images without snuffing out the abuse, that we have not gone far enough, speaking both as a human being and as a father. And so therefore, of course it has to involve police work, because if your full response to finding images that depict the sexual abuse of minors is to remove those images from the internet without doing police work, then the minors continue to be victimized. And there is some sense in which you've reduced their victimization, assuming that they're shut of that situation and the images of the crimes committed against them are no longer in circulation. But in terms of our social priorities, I think it's a very easy reach to say that our social priority should be to stop ongoing and future abuse of children ahead of, although not necessarily exclusive of, the circulation of the evidence of that. That if we had to choose between those two, that it's an easy choice, right?
And isn't there a case to be made that if we spend all of our time trying to stop the circulation of the evidence, then it actually becomes harder to find people because they're on the dark web, they're encrypting their conversations, and at least if it's a little more out there, and I'm not advocating, of course, sharing of child pornography, but if it's out there, it might be easier to trace people and then get the stopping the actual abuse as opposed to the evidence. Can there be a can a case be made for the fact that the more open and free people are, the easier it is to stop that sort of thing?
So there's a group of German survivors of sexual abuse who are adults who were sexually abused as children, who formed a movement to oppose the use of a national firewall to block websites in which this was being discussed or shared or whatever, because they said that out of sight is out of mind. And I kind of feel like this is an area where I want to defer to survivors.
Mm-hmm.
That as someone who, touch wood, not a survivor of that kind of abuse, never had to suffer through that kind of abuse, I want to take my lead from people who've lived through it. And so that's the organized group I know about, and that's their view. I think, as you point out, that there's no clear and easy answer
right.
to the best way to manage it. And, you know, we could use something slightly less emotionally charged, although not much less emotionally charged, like the atrocities committed against the Rohingya or the Yazidi. So the Yazidi shared on social media huge amounts of images of themselves being tormented by jihadis, of human rights abuses visited on them by the jihadis, as a way of galvanizing public opinion to support themselves. And the same algorithms and moderators, human moderators, who were charged with removing jihadi propaganda, which often featured the same images, began to take down their images too. And the Yazidi, I think, correctly understood that their only chance for justice would be to build constituencies around the world of people who understood what they were going through. And so I think that it's, if nothing else, an area that's very hard to do well, and it's hard to do at scale. And it's very hard to distinguish between the people who want to tell their stories as a way of galvanizing people to action or healing themselves, and people who want to glorify the abuse. It's certainly something that's very hard to do when you're a giant company, right? It's very hard for something the size of Facebook to do, because they find it hard to understand the context. There's so much of it that they're always going to catch some dolphins in their tuna net. And I think it's a pretty good argument for decentralizing communications, right? If we had more decentralized communications, it might be harder to find the bad speech, but it would also mean that people of goodwill who are running services that knowing all the speech and its context in that service would be more tractable for them. It's I think an argument for a more decentralized internet overall. In terms of the non-consensual sharing of nudity of people who made the pictures consensually, but then found them shared non-consensually. Again, I think that there are two dimensions here. One is the prevention of the re-victimization of that person by having their images shared. And in general, it's an area where I think, you know, the notice and takedown regime is not a terrible one, right? Where prior to the internet, if there was something published that you believed was bad speech of some kind, it infringed copyright, it infringed some other right that you had, you would have to get a court order to get it removed. You know, when I worked in a bookstore, if you thought one of the books we sold infringed your copyright or defamed you, you didn't get to just march into the store, grab me from behind the cash register, walk me over to the bookshelf and demand that I remove the book, right? You would have to produce a court order before the book would disappear. On the internet, if you feel like you have been, you've been maligned or your rights have been trampled under things like the Communications Decency Act and the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, you can use takedown notices to make things remove, arguably so easily that it invites abuse. You know, we've seen, for example, police departments whose body cam footage of them committing violent acts, illegal violent acts, have used false copyright claims to make things disappear from the public eye, at least for a time, often at critical junctures when it's a matter of public debate. But I think that takedown is a good system for it, addressing some of that re-victimization harm. But as with the sharing of images of the sexual abuse of children, I think that the criminal pursuit of people who intentionally share non-consensual nude images or images that are being shared non-consensual, even if the images were consensual, that pursuing those people is actually the more important thing. You know, it's like asking, do we need blinds to stop people from peering through our windows with telescopes? Or do we need social norms backed up by legal regimes that make it both unacceptable and illegal to stare through your window with a telescope? And I would say that blinds are great, but ultimately the thing that protects us from people looking through our windows is the norm and the law.
We're running out of time, but I want to go back a second to the thing that you mentioned about people using images of victims, sometimes for advocacy and sometimes for prurient interests. And there's two sort of internet pop culture notions that this makes me think of. The first is called Rule 34, which is if it exists, there's porn of it. And the second is Poe's Law, which says that it's impossible to tell the difference between if something is extreme enough, it's impossible to tell the difference between something that is meant seriously and something that is satire. Are these the same sort of problems? Are these all epistemological problems, problems of knowledge, problems of interpreting people's intentions? Does this permeate the internet? I know it's very hard to express sarcasm through email and sarcasm through text.
Right.
Is there a fundamental and perhaps even unique epistemological problem for the internet that it makes it harder to understand people's intentionality? Or is that, again, sort of just a manifestation of the larger problem that we as human beings have of paying attention and interpreting other people?
So I think that there's at least two things going on. So one thing about the internet is that it exposes cultural interchange to people who weren't privy to the initial context, right? So any one of us can be an anthropologist hiding in the bushes watching two people do something that we don't understand. You know, there's this famous essay by Cliff Geertz about how anthropologists who see, one person wink at another person can't know whether that, like, it's flirting or it's a sign of aggression or whether one of them just got grit in their eye. And you have to, come down out of your perch and go and ask them why they winked. And they may not tell you the truth or they may not know the truth, but you'll be more illuminated than you would if you just sit there watching them. And so the internet definitely exposes us to a lot of material whose context we're not privy to, that we can't know. I think of queer friends of mine who use words like fag in conversation with one another, but then who have that taken out of context and who are accused of being homophobes themselves, and how that is... clearly, like, that the removal of context is being used sometimes in bad faith to arrive at an incorrect impression of what the nature of their interchange with their colleagues was. But then the other thing that happens is that there is a doctrine among the bigger platforms that militates against keeping different contexts for different communications. Mark Zuckerberg, very famously, he said, if you act in one way with one person and another way with another person, then you're two-faced, and that Facebook doesn't want you to have two identities that you show to two different people because it's dishonest. Well, like, I would hate to be that guy's mom because clearly he talks to her the same way he talks to his boss and his wife and his daughter, right?
Right.
If that's your view, right, that you should talk to everyone the same way and you should only have one context. But, what Zuckerberg really means is it's just self-serving. If you only have one context, it's easier to figure out how to target you with ads. And everything else is just, philosophical window dressing or, backed form rationalization. But to the extent that we have these, malignant context collapses where it's hard to figure out what people mean and it leads us astray and it puts us in conflict with each other, at least part of that is a deliberate choice, right? Someone said, well, that'll probably happen. And it will be sad for the people involved, but we'll certainly make more money if we engineer it so it does. Not because we want them to be in conflict with each other, but because it makes it easier for us to spy on them. And that's their misery is a price we're willing to pay. I think it's a conscious choice. No one came down off a mountain with two stone tablets saying, thou shalt stop rotating thine log files from thine web server and instead mine them for actionable market intelligence. These are choices that people made, and they could have made different ones.
I think we have to stop here. I don't want to stop here. I would like to talk for another 2-3 hours. Our engineers will kill us. Our audience will – I don't think we'd lose the audience, but we need to take – we need to put a period somewhere in the paragraph.
All right.
Corey, this conversation was so interesting and so challenging and was so nuanced in ways that I didn't expect. I'm thrilled and I'm pleased, and I know I'm going to be thinking about this for a very long time. Thank you so much for joining us on Why.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed it, too. It was absolutely my pleasure. I'm honored to have been put on your show.
You've been listening to Corey Doctorow and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussion of Everyday Life. I recommend Corey's the two books that I'm familiar with, Information Doesn't Want to Be Free, and his new book, Radicalized, which is 4 novellas in one. And when you read it, I would like you to tell me if my theory is correct that the two main characters, well, the main character and the new character in the first novella, Unauthorized Bread, are in love, because I think they are. Anyway, you've been listening to Why Philosophical Discussion in Everyday Life. We'll be back right after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Y Radio store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We were talking with Cory Doctorow about the internet and about how to keep it free and what that might mean in the first place. I think a lot of the listeners will have the same experience of this episode that I did. We started out thinking we were going to have a technical conversation, had a little conversation about science fiction, and then bam, right? Political theory, economics, a fair amount of cynicism. It was pretty intense. Now, this is philosopher's pay dirt. I live for this kind of stuff, but it can be a little overwhelming. But here's the thing. That's what the internet is in our life. We think of it as a tool, but when we we think of it as a tool. And when we take a step back, we realize it has permeated every aspect of every part of our day. And how do you talk about something like that without just exploding all of your ideas all over the place? Now, that's not a criticism of Cory. I think his comments were tremendously brilliant. It was more about me and my sense of how to move from a narrow conversation to an expansive conversation very quickly. These are the best conversations. These are the conversations that stick with us. These are the conversations that you listen to over and over again, and you think, oh, I missed that. Oh, I thought that. Oh, this leads to that. Let me connect the dots. And the thing about the internet is that whatever it means in our life, it overlaps so many different aspects that there's no way to really talk about just one part of it. I learned a lot from Cory today. Most particularly, I learned that to have the conversation about technology, you really have to have it in the political and ethical and historical context. But in order to have the discussion about the context, you also have to have the discussion about the technology. You can't do one without the other. Now, I'm a reasonably technical guy. I understand the electronics to a certain extent. I can fix a lot of my computers. But the wide expanse of how the internet works is beyond me. And now I realize I have to know a lot more about it. I realize that in order to understand the philosophy behind the internet, I have to understand the infrastructure and the mechanisms as well. That's a daunting task. But it's a wonderful task because it's going to put me in contact with a lot of new people and a lot of new ideas. And in the end, I think it'll be rich ground for future philosophical discussions that I will need a lifetime to explore. And that's the best gift of all. You've been listening to Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Thanks for listening. As always, it's an honor to be with you.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. Skip Wood is our studio engineer. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua y Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/Mark Weinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.